Hi and welcome to the iBuy IMD podcast, where IMD faculty meets global experts to bring you the latest on the evolving world of management and business. And here's your host of today's episode, Murak Taracuk. Enjoy.
Welcome to the iBuy IMD podcast. I'm Murak Taracuk, Professor of Innovation Strategy. Our guest today is Ralph Hamers, former CEO of ING and UBS, two of the largest banks in Europe. We are together on the IMD campus in Lausanne. Ralph, thank you for joining me.
You're welcome. Looking forward to this session.
Fantastic. Your first book is coming up this week. Do Your Thing, Lessons from Banking's Biggest Digital Transformation. The book tells the inside story of the transformation you led at ING and offers a leadership framework for organizations facing disruption, digital and AI, or the next wave of technological shifts. I must ask this. How does your family feel about the book? Can they finally stop listening to your stories but read them?
Well, honestly, so being a CEO makes you be very cautious as to sharing what you do at home. So my family, of course, have read the story from the outside in terms of what was covered in the newspapers, but they didn't really get the story from within. So for them, it's also the first time they can actually read it.
Oh, that's nice. So some homework to do for them as well. Before we come to the book, I want to ask about the context behind it. So most leadership books focus on the dramatic, the heroic CEO who arrives and has to lead through a crisis. But we know much less about the CEO who rebuilds, who transforms. By the time you took over in October 2013, ING has already been stabilized, repaid much of the state aid, and divested over 50 businesses. You inherited an organization no longer dying, but desperately in need for survival for 5 years. So please take us back at that time and tell us what you saw and how is reconstruction is as challenging as crisis leadership.
Yeah, just going back as you asked. So you were in a situation where, as you indicated, the situation has been stabilized by selling many different parts of ING. And doing the restructuring was based on what I refer to as a burning platform. So basically, people saw the financial crisis, people saw the financial results of the banks. So people are very open to change because they see that something needs to change. And therefore, you know, restructuring is generally a reaction to a burning platform. When I took over, the situation was stabilized, and I had to figure out a way to rebuild. And the rebuilding is done from a foundation that is left. So the first step I needed to do is, what is left from our DNA? And how can I translate that DNA into a purpose that will guide us going forward? So basically, I started by building the foundation of a story and by developing a purpose for the company. And then on the back of that, given the fact that people really wanted to hear a new story as to where the future was going, I needed to basically develop a burning ambition for change.
Oh, that's interesting.
So the difference between restructuring on the back of a burning platform, which is very easy for people to see, I had to develop a transformation on the back of a burning ambition. And what I used for that is that while we were going through restructuring, the market changed very rapidly. We saw fintechs coming up. We saw big tech coming into the financial world. As a consequence of which, I basically was able to show a future where we needed to change very quickly as well. Because it's not necessarily the results of today that were under pressure, but certainly the results of tomorrow that were under pressure. And that's why I needed to come with a burning ambition. And for that, I needed to develop a compelling story for people to follow. And that is more difficult because now you have to basically convince people on something that is coming at you that you see and not everybody sees yet. So you need to take them along in that story. You need to create buy-in for the change and then change the company as well as the behavior of your people. That is why there is a big difference between restructuring and transformation. restructuring to find stabilization versus transformation to find growth.
That's very interesting. What we are saying is that the platform doesn't stop burning. And I love how you reframe it, not as a burning platform, but having a burning ambition for employees to look forward to. Your book is built on this exact framework. It has two halves, right? The external facing half connects purpose to strategy, customer promise, and brand. And the internal facing half connects purpose to leadership, culture, and execution. So purpose is at the center, the connecting tissue between these two halves. So these all sound familiar to our listeners. What is unique about this framework? And can you also walk us through what did you actually do at ING that other CEOs often miss when they try to hold all these two halves together?
Yeah, I think, Murat, you're quite right in saying that the framework itself may be always there intuitively.
Yes.
I think what I did on the back of the experience with ING, but also UBS, is I made the framework more explicit. I wrote it down. And if you write it down, it becomes very explicit, and then you can start working with it. Rather than that intuitively you follow, but you may forget. I think that's a big difference in this case. And specifically, again, remember the burning ambition rather than the burning platform. If you want to create and lead this transformation, you should realize that all of the elements in the framework need to be managed in a continuous and in a consistent way. And it is up to the CEO and nobody else to do that. Because I'm a firm believer that if you initiate a comprehensive transformation, you cannot delegate what your strategy is, what your brand stands for, how you people behave, the talent that you need, and the skills that you need to develop. Because whatever you promise on the outside through a customer promise and a brand needs to be delivered on the inside. Those dots, as I call them, you have to connect those dots. You need to do that in a consistent way because otherwise it will not be authentic. So you have to work the framework, and that's why I made it more explicit. And again, I think many CEOs will have an intuition about the framework, but I actually made it more explicit and I basically determined it so that people can now take it and work it.
That's wonderful. And it worked. It worked very well. What I know about ING, and you wrote about this in detail as well, is that you wanted innovation to be part of the culture, not a department. If I may, you created actually more than an innovation culture. You build an innovation ecosystem. Just to give you a couple of examples from an outsider, you build internal boot camps, feeding accelerator labs in different cities. A $300 million venture fund called ING Ventures, and importantly, an agile operating model to support all of this. Where does that innovation engine sit inside your framework? And what should a CEO trying to build a similar innovation ecosystem around their organization today actually do?
Yes, so innovation, for the sake of innovation, is not what I was looking for. We are companies. We are client-focused. So everything starts with the client. And my book deals for a whole chapter with the client as to how do you put the customer at the core of everything you do. And if you have a client promise, a clear client promise, then it's the innovation that you need in order to deliver on that promise. So we didn't organize innovation for innovation's sake, and therefore innovation itself does not have a place in the framework. But the behavior that you need and the technology that you need in order to create the innovation, in order to deliver on your customer promise, is in the framework. And the way we went about innovation at ING is actually in three different ways. And that is basically the framework that you're probably asking for as to how will others be able to do innovation. The first way, which is the more structural way to innovate, is that we changed our way of working. So rather than a vertical approach around we have a marketing department that comes up with a product idea, a product development that developed the product and operations department that develops the process around it, and the technology department that actually then codes for it to be delivered in a digital way. That's not how we want it to work. That takes too long. So we went to the agile way of working. We were the first incumbent to basically copy from the Googles and the Spotifys of this world to work in multifunctional teams, in squads as we call them. Multifunctional teams that were empowered to deliver almost on the spot in 2-week sprints in multifunctional teams with marketing, product, technology in the team itself. End-to-end responsibility as to continuously improving, continuously innovating an existing process or an additional feature in your app or on a product. That is the first way to innovate, and that is a very structured way. But it needs a direction, and the direction is the customer promise. The second way to innovate for us was that I called literally upon everyone working for ING to come up with ideas of a new business model, a new product, a new service. And I basically asked them to take 48 hours of their working week to come up with an idea. And if their direct bosses had a problem with that, they should call me. I just wanted to unleash that energy in an organization like ING to come up with all of these ideas, and basically told them that we had 25 million euros reserved and protected against cost cutting as well, right? Which is what you need to do in large organizations, in order for them to be sure and convinced that whatever idea they would come up with, that would be taken seriously, and if they would make it to the finals of the bootcamp, that it would actually be funded, which it did. And we did that every year. That's the second way, which is more kind of a moonshot way, basically. Mm-hmm. And then the third way to innovate is that you should always be modest, which basically means that no one has a monopoly on good ideas. There is many good ideas out there that your people or your organization will not be coming up with. So that's the fintech world. The fintech world that, you know, tries, has new ideas that you have to continuously screen to get a sense for, are there any new initiatives out there that fit what we want to do, what we want to deliver to our customers? And that's what we set the investment fund up for in order to support that. So three ways, which is almost a continuous innovation through agile way of working. The second one through boot camps, bigger, almost moonshot-like ideas. And the third one is continue to look outside in the market. There may be better ideas out there. And if you want to kind of get the benefit of those, invest early.
I love it. So you unleashed the burning energy inside the organization, but also you welcomed burning energy from outside in. And this is in line with your platform banking strategy, which was radical at that time for an incumbent. The principle was to deliver the right product to the client, not necessarily your own product. If the customer's needs are addressed by someone else's products, you would welcome it, let it be your competitor or fintech. How successful was that strategy? And what would you do differently today?
Yeah, indeed. Just going back to 2013, 2014, it was very apparent that people and companies would need banking, but not banks per se. It's not necessarily the institution that they need, but they need to be able to make a payment. But in that, we should realize that what a bank does is never serving a primary need. Consumers would want to have a coffee, and while buying the coffee, they need to be paying for it. So we are just facilitating them wanting the coffee. The payment itself is not a primary need. It's a secondary need, and it should be as smooth as possible. The same for a mortgage, right? If you're a mortgage provider, it's not a primary need, the mortgage. The primary need is that people want to buy a house. People wake up wanting to buy a house or wanting to drink a cup of coffee. Nobody wakes up wanting to do banking. So therefore, the institution as a bank is not what people need. But the function of the bank, banking, is what they need. And that is what you should be really aware of. So in that aspect, there is two additional things that we basically started working with. The first one is that we should, in order to deliver these services to these customers, also on the wholesale side, as smooth as possible, we needed to embrace technology as a really important capability. And therefore, we said we have to build a tech company with a banking license. Tech, we determined tech as so fundamentally important in order to deliver on our customer promise that, you know, by just using the one liner saying, well, we want to be a tech company with a banking license, that's the model we go for. And honestly, I think we got fairly far in terms of making sure that people in the organization, bankers as well, embrace technology as part of what they should understand and not something that they could delegate to another department, because it became so fundamental in how you deliver your service. The second aspect of building that platform was about, as you just indicated, is that we should service these clients the best product available,
exactly,
which may not necessarily be our own product. Now, if you're a new player, that is easy because you have no products. So if you're a new player and you're interacting with your customers and you see there's a demand for a particular product and there's a third party out there that you can hook onto your platform through an API and service your clients with it, it is easy. I said, I want to build a bank without a balance sheet. And the inspiration I took was from the biggest hotel company in the world, which is Airbnb.
Yes.
But they have no hotel rooms. Or the biggest media company in the world, which is Facebook or Instagram, but they don't produce any content. So can you be the biggest bank in the world without having your own products? Now, I do think you can if you start from scratch. As an incumbent, to move into that direction proved a little bit more difficult, because if you look at the balance sheet and the income it generates, then moving away from the income on the balance sheet makes you have to decrease your cost as well. And that is a difficult phenomenon then to work towards, because you really have to cannibalize on your own business all the time. So I think that that only came through in a more slower way by adding new services that we were not building ourselves, and that would generate more fees. And honestly, I think that only over the last couple of years you saw that coming through in the ING model. So it took a long time to be that bank without necessarily a balance sheet.
That's amazing. Building such an ecosystem, being such an ecosystem orchestrator, sounds like also a leadership challenge. What were your struggles at that time? How did you try to convince not only your organization, but also whole ecosystem that this is the right play?
Yeah, so it's in the end, it's all about a vision and a burning ambition that I was...
Yes.
That I was talking about, and also inspiring people with examples from outside of the banking industry. I always say that if you want to lead in your industry, look outside of your industry. Because if you look within your industry, you can't lead, you're copying. So, I mean, it's a contradiction in itself. So if you want to lead in your industry, you need to take the inspiration from outside of the industry. And that's what I did. And building models and ideas around that tech needs to be important and the whole platform banking, that is something that you then kind of just start developing. And honestly, you have to be open to the fact that some of that may just not work, right? So I think in my book, it is also clear that in some of the ecosystem plays that we tried to make, that many of these initiatives were successful, but some were not. And some because of the culture of the people, and some because people just didn't expect a banking service to be part of an overall service. And some were just too early maybe as well.
Wonderful. So the framework makes sense. It's very insightful. And the results at ING speak for themselves. The question remains is that to what extent this framework is generalizable? Let me put it that way. I might buy a lottery ticket today and I win the lottery, and I can write a book saying that everyone should buy a lottery ticket because I won, everyone can get rich as well. How generalizable is this framework? Specifically, you became the CEO of UBS in 2020 with same framework in your mind, in your pocket, which you had refined at ING. How different UBS was then ING, and please walk us through how you applied the framework at UBS. Did the framework itself had to flex, or was it generalizable to a bank in a completely different country, different size, and so on?
Well, certainly a different bank. Otherwise, I would not have moved to it, because I wanted to do something new after I finished what I thought was my story of ING in 2020, and I moved to a completely different challenge, and UBS was certainly a completely different challenge. And I have to admit that the framework, the way I have developed it in the book, was until that moment more in my drawer, on my own, in my own documents, and I never made it explicit for the others. I managed ING according to the framework because I knew the framework. When I started at UBS, I wanted to test the framework. So it's exactly what I did. Can I actually use the same framework for UBS? And can I generalize it, as you so nicely say? And I did, because when I arrived at UBS, I think UBS was in a good shape, financially good shape. It was stabilized as well. And it had four divisions, but the four divisions have their own strategies. And there was a lack of a real compelling future story around how these divisions would develop and how UBS would be seen as one. So I just worked according to my framework. So there was no purpose within UBS. So the first step I needed to do with a lot of people working in UBS is check what is the DNA of UBS and how can we translate that DNA into something that is truly our purpose. So that was number one, step number one. The second step then after the purpose was, okay, so what is then our strategy? What is the strongest part of our business? Where is the real future potential? And from the same analysis, it was very clear that the pivot for UBS internationally would be more on wealth management. And where an investment bank and an asset manager were important parts, but to support that wealth management strategy. So the strategy became less four different divisional strategies, but more one UBS strategy. And if you want to deliver on that one, you go back into the framework, you needed to have different behaviors. Where at ING, you know, staying a step ahead, which is, you know, being forward-looking, was a crucial behavioral element that we needed to introduce to be innovative. In UBS, in order to extract the value of all the strength that it had in view of the client promise, it was much more important for the people to start to collaborate, because clients would take services from the different divisions, but basically experience different UBSs. So the one UBS as a strategy became also the one UBS as an experience towards our clients. But if you want to deliver on that experience, we needed to have the collaboration to be emphasized between people and between divisions. So here you see the framework approach, but of course with different solutions for a different bank, because the challenge is different and the potential that you want to kind of develop is completely different. So the framework worked, and it was basically confirmed that if you take this framework on any strategic challenge, you can actually deal with it, and it worked for you.
Interesting. Let's go back to the burning platform. And we concluded that platform always burns. When you were at ING, at UBS, there were other tensions in the market. Today, the fire is about AI. You note in the book that AI is the next wave of change that organizations need to adapt. What is your vision for AI in finance and banking over the next decade? And when you look at your framework, which of the eight elements does AI put the most pressure on it? And when it comes to executing that framework, which you just said for UBS, how does AI shape executing the strategy?
Yeah, this is the ultimate test, I guess. I think, again, also on this one. So I don't think there is a lot of burning platforms that are visible. So therefore, also for the financial sector, and look at how the stock market and the stock prices are developing these days for the financial sector, people think there is not a burning platform. So again, you know, rather than saying, well, we're not doing well, you have to explain the story as to if we don't embrace AI, we may not be doing well in the future. So therefore, again, you have to translate this into a burning ambition, a future story. And then in that, on the finance side, in the financial market side, I actually think that technology has always been embraced by the banks in general. People always say, yeah, banks don't change. But I think banks have been remarkably resilient as well as adaptive to technology. If I, for the older listeners maybe to this podcast, just go back to the 80s when we saw stockbrokers on the stock exchange floor, you know, noting quotes on paper and yelling at each other and shouting at each other. And from one day to the other, with the computerization of the trade, with the electronification of the trade, these floors were empty from one day to the other. Not in a week, not in 2 weeks, from one day to the other. It's either it is electronic or it is shouting on the floor. It's one of the two. You can't mix them.
I would pick electronic all day long.
Exactly. And that then moved also into the payments and cash management sphere. Also in the first moves around automation. Then digitalization came. And with digitalization, banks actually saw another opportunity to make their processes more efficient, but even more so to make their user experience for their clients much better. So again, they embraced and didn't let themselves disrupt by new players. And of course, there's new players that building from scratch are doing phenomenally well. But in the end, banks did adopt and adapt, right? And I think with AI, it's the same thing. So if you look at banks or the financial industry as a whole, they're fairly well prepared for the AI challenge. They have all strong data management skills. They have governance around models as to how you manage models, how you backtest models, how you validate models, how you allow ethical models versus non-ethical models, how you test that. So you need models that help you take these decisions as to where the risk is higher, but in an ethical way. And the financial world is a little bit further than many other industries in that. So I think AI will be an incredible opportunity for the financial world to take it to the next level. The financial world will adapt with it. And I think the financial world is a little bit ahead of most of the other industries in this. Now, then coming back to the framework, because that was your original question as to which element, it really depends on where you are. If you are currently an organization and you don't have a real strong purpose, strategy, or customer promise, it doesn't really matter. Then you really have to look at AI as to, is this a strategic opportunity or is it a tactical opportunity? If it's a tactical opportunity, you can't use my framework. If it is a strategic opportunity, then you have to use the framework. And then if you don't have the purpose yet, you start in the top, then you have to develop a purpose. If you have that and you have a strategy and it's only about the customer promise, look at whether you can change the customer promise with the opportunity that AI brings, right? So it really depends on where you are in the framework, what you have developed really well already, as to where AI will have its biggest impact.
Let's build on that. Let's actually hold the hands of our listeners. Our listeners are leaders experiencing these technological changes wave after wave after wave, as you described. So how can a leader use your framework on Monday morning to make sense of AI in their own organization? Where do they start? What do they do first?
Yeah, it's interesting. That's what I wrote the book for, right? It's honestly. So I wrote the book to share my experience. And some will love it, some may not like it. I don't know, it's not the point. But from my experience of being a CEO for 10 years for globally systemic banks, I wanted to share my learning so that future CEOs don't have to make the same mistakes. They can make their own mistakes, let me put it that way, right? So, and because we all learn and we all have to try. But my book is literally for that CEO on Monday morning. And I actually have a chapter specifically on this as to how you have to deal with the framework. So first, you develop the vertical axis of that framework. And it's difficult for the readers to have to think what is the vertical axis in my book or in the framework. But it starts with purpose. And then it is about strategy, then it's about the customer promise, and then it's about the execution of it. This is generally all kind of more conceptually. So just test whether you have a very valid strategy and whether you have a very clear customer promise to deliver on. The way that translates externally, you can also check as to, okay, so what is my brand promise? How do I manage my reputation? And then on the other side, and this is now the hard work, is just, how do you deliver on it? Do I have the right leadership? Do I have the right talent? Do I have the right skills? Do I have the right incentives? Do I have the right behavioral elements determined in order to live up to that brand or that customer promise or that reputational goal that I have. If you're not, you can't go out with it, right? So again, you know, it's the CEO that need to connect the dots. You can't go out with a brand promise if internally you can't deliver on it. It's not a marketing gimmick, and therefore it has to be consistent. Otherwise, it is not authentic. And one thing clients will always notice is if your promise is not authentic, if you can't deliver on it.
Thank you for already sharing the insights from the book. In the book, you also highlight that the hardest part of any transformation was not redesigning systems or improving the customer's experience or learning, as you emphasized, but it was unlearning habits that had once been rewarded. What did you personally have to unlearn that was painful?
It is clear that if you come out with a clear ambition and you expect 50,000 people to change their behavior, to develop their skills, that you have to set the example. And in setting the example, clearly, you know, I had to develop as well. And I took my leadership through my own development. And in the book, I basically shared it as well. But in the end, there's two things that I found painful. Because development itself, you can always do in skills, but there's two things that I found more difficult than other things, let me put it that way. The first thing is more personal, which is I'm not a person that seeks confrontation easily. And if you're managing from a burning platform perspective, everybody sees the need for change. Yes. So if you then announce that they need to change, if you then announce that they need to reskill, and if you then announce job cuts, people understand. But I can tell you, if you've worked for a company like ING for 29 years as I did, and you have orange blood running through your veins, announcing changes to the organization, announcing the need for skill upgrades, announcing the need for jobs to change, and for people maybe to lose their jobs, just because you have an ambition, a burning ambition, rather than a burning platform, is more difficult. And I found that really difficult. The second thing that I found more difficult was I truly believe that if you have talented people, and generally we all have talented people around us, that you should empower them to move. Go for it, right? And the culture that we set as part of the transformation was very much a culture of empowerment, empowerment of leadership. And empowerment, of course, comes with the other side of the same medal, which is accountability, right? You can't ask for empowerment if you don't accept the accountability that goes with the decisions that you are then empowered to take. Now, through the empowerment, we created a lot of movement in the right direction in the first stage of the transformation. So decentrally, the countries were changing in the right direction. Technology was being cleaned up. Products were being cleaned up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But at a certain moment, like 3 years into the transformation, in order to really effectively create scale, we needed to do further cross-border standardization. In terms of the customer experience, for example, like why can't we have this the same app in every country? Why can't we have the same way to exchange and interact with large business clients in every country, which you can standardize? But also in the back end, how do you manage your technology? How do you do your data management and your risk management? You can standardize as well. And in the middle, clearly, when the product level, you saw that still local regulations would not allow you to standardize. But where we could standardize, we moved to standardization. But standardization cross-border is also taking away the empowerment. So where I'm a firm believer in empowerment, and we created a lot of momentum in the speed of development at country level to thereafter start more of a central coordination around standardization, that is something I needed to learn.
Sounds really easier than done. Fantastic. Thank you for sharing this, Ralph. I want to go back to AI. You recently became the chairman of the Banking Circle. I want to ask you about your vision, how you see AI unfolding by 2030, for example. Clearly, you have a point of view. Can you please share your vision of AI, AI agents, and how the technology is evolving in banking and finance?
I'm generally kind of a person who sets bold ideas, right? So when I came out in 2013 and say, well, you know, the world will only need their mobile phones to do banking, I was ridiculed. It's very interesting. Now everybody does their banking on their mobile phone, right? And not saying that, you know, my vision going forward and on this one is right. But if you just take the evolution in banking, as I was just explaining, you know, the computerization of transactions, thereafter the automation of processes, the digitalization of the user experience, all of that has changed banking fundamentally. It's all about efficiency and a better service. Now with AI, it's most likely the final step in what bankers do, which is the intellectual capacity of advising clients. And I actually think that going forward, advice to clients can be better generated through AI than through an advisor. What do I mean with that? If, for example, in the wealth management space, if you're discussing with a client about their needs, you try to translate that into liquidity needs in the future, legacy that they want to build up, risk appetite that they have as well. And those are concepts that you can put in the model. On the other side, in terms of these needs that are translated into that model, in order to answer those, there is thousands of products out there in the market to address those needs. There is just no advisor in the world that can match all of the possible products that are out there with these needs of these clients, right? So AI will be much better at solving
definitely
that issue. So the quality of the advice, the content of the advice, and the continuous update or even instant update of that advice, instant, I'm meaning instant, every day, every minute of that advice, depending on rate changes, market changes, or risk appetite changes from the client's perspective, cannot be done by an advisor. So the quality of the advice and the content of the advice will be much more driven by AI. And therefore, the role of the advisor will still be there, by the way, which I think will further evolve towards the empathy factor as well as the trust factor. But the actual content of the advice and the continuous instant updating of it, I think that will be much better done by AI.
Very interesting. Ralph, this has been a remarkable conversation. You have walked us through a legendary corporate reconstruction, rebuilding ING in a sense, an innovation strategy that other banks are still trying to copy, and a framework that has now been tested across two very different banks. And thank you also for sharing your insights about AI and how the future will unfold. Thank you for this insightful conversation.
You're welcome.
For our listeners, the book is Do Your Thing, Lessons from Banking's Biggest Digital Transformation. I would strongly encourage you to read it, whether or not you work in finance and banking. The lessons are universal for any leader. Ralph, thank you again for joining me today.
If you enjoyed this conversation with Ralph Hamers, hosted by Murat Tarakshu, subscribe to iBuyIMD on your favorite podcast platform. iBuyIMD is brought to you by the Institute for Management Development. Find out more at imd.org. See you soon.